he was doing this, nor when he pulled the sword out and leaned forward to stretch out his neck, whereupon the kaishaku would stand up and cut off his head with one swift stroke. I shuddered and closed the book, thinking that my idea of honour and courage were very different to those of the bushi. I got up to return the books to their places, and I looked around for Serenity. I didn't find her, which meant this must be the one time she had broken her slavish ritual of Monday nights at the city library. Just my luck. There were some phone booths at the side of the library, and I went to ring Da. It was cold enough that my breath came out in frosty plumes. I stopped on the top step to button my blazer, hoping Da wouldn't take too long. Then I saw Serenity, standing on the footpath under a streetlight. As if she felt me staring at her, she turned. When she saw it was me, her expression darkened. "Have you been following me?" she snapped. "Course not," I said indignantly. "I came to do some research. I was going to get a lift home from Da when he picked you up. Where were you anyway? I didn't see you inside." "I was in there," Serenity said defiantly. She turned back to the street, and right at that moment, Da pulled up.
"I didn't realize you came here together," he said cheerfully as we got in.
I left it to Serenity to tell him we had come there separately, but she said nothing. Da asked what we had been studying, and again Serenity said nothing, so I told him what I could remember about Bushido and then about seppuku. Da said he didn't see how killing yourself could fix your honour. "Do you think anyone still commits seppuku?" I asked him.
"I think most people would find less painful ways of dying," Da said.
I thought I heard Serenity mutter something, but when I looked around, her face was bland, and she was staring out the window. At home, Miranda was cooking, and the house smelled deliciously of Swiss cheese and vegetable frittata. I was hungry enough for two serves, but I noticed that Serenity ate only when Da was looking at her. The rest of the time, she fiddled with her food, trying to rearrange it to make it look as if she'd eaten more than she had. Was it possible she had one of those dieting diseases? Anorexia, since I supposed I would have heard her throwing up if it was bulimia. She went to our room after dinner, saying she had a headache. I didn't want to go up and have her glowering resentfully at me, or lying there in the dark, grimly pretending to sleep, so I stayed to help dry the dishes and listen to a new song Da had recorded. Jesse had also gone up to his room, but Miranda stayed, saying she would help. 3 teaspoons in, the phone rang, and she threw the tea towel down and went to answer it. But instead of beginning to gossip to Ricky, she got an odd look on her face and turned to hold out the receiver to me. "It's Harlan Sanderson for you, Alison," she said coyly. I managed to contain my reaction, but the effort made me feel slightly sick. "Harlan?" I spoke pleasantly into the phone.
"Hi, Alison,"
Harlan said, his voice sounding deeper and older on the phone.
"I didn't get a chance to talk to you today after Barking cancelled the excursion to Skaven. You want to come out for a while now?"
My heart started pounding as I tried to think how to answer.
"Alison?"
Sorry, Harlan, I can hardly hear you. We must have a bad connection."
"Is this better?" he said loudly. "I said, do you want to come out for a while? I'm over your part of town, in the Eastland Mall."
How does he know where my part of town is? I wondered uneasily. But I only said, "I wouldn't be allowed tonight. I have to look after my baby brother." There was a long pause. Then Harlan was saying in a friendly voice,
"Some other time, then. I guess I should meet your parents first."
"Yes," I said, trying to sound enthusiastic. "I'd better get off now. My sister's waiting for a call."
"Okay, we'll talk tomorrow," Harlan said.
He rang off, and when I put the receiver down, I saw that my hands were shaking.
"What's the matter, Ali?" Da asked.
"I don't know. Maybe I got up too fast."
"That's no surprise, considering who was on the phone," Miranda said.
"I can't believe you just played hard to get with Harlan Sanderson." Da asked me,
"Who is Harlan Sanderson?"
"Only the school pin-up," Miranda said drolly. "What's your secret, darling?" she demanded in Rona's voice, pretending to poke a mic in my face. "My underarm deodorant," I said so seriously that it took them a minute to realize I had made a joke. Then they laughed. I was glad to have put them off, but inside I was still quaking. The only good thing about the call was that Harlan had not mentioned being at school on the weekend, so maybe he hadn't been waiting for me after all. That night, I dreamed that I was inside a samurai warrior who was preparing for seppuku. I was trying my hardest to stop him, because I would die if he died. I had control of my will, but he had control of his body. I couldn't make his body obey me, and when he lifted the sword point, I felt a sense of helpless terror. Then the warrior glanced sideways, and I was aghast to see Harlan sitting beside me as Kaishaku.
"I know what's inside you," Harlan whispered.
The shock woke me. 17. I made sure I arrived so late the next morning that there was no chance of bumping into Harlan at the lockers, but when I saw my name on the notice board for bin duty, I nearly had a heart attack. I thought Harlan had written us in together, then I saw it was Jilly's name next to mine. "Hope you didn't mind me nominating you as my partner," she said, when we met to collect our bins and spikes. "Not at all. I'm proud to be the one you want to pick up moldy crusts with." She laughed. "I thought you might rather be with Harlan. He was looking for you at the bus stop this morning." I didn't say anything for a while. Then I said, "He called my place last night. He asked me out, but I told him I couldn't go." She stared at me sympathetically. "Did your dad say you couldn't?" "I didn't want to," I told her. Jilly thought I was joking, of course. "This is Harlan. Every girl in the school has a crush on him, Sanderson, we're talking about." "Yes," I said, fiercely and unhappily, and her amusement faded. "I just don't get why he's so suddenly interested in me." "I know why," Jilly said kindly, and I stared at her. "Alizon, you were always a nice person, but these days it's like something in you is radiating this energy that... oh, I can't describe it, but I bet that's why Harlan suddenly got so keen." She took my expression as puzzlement and elaborated. "I mean, it's like when you walk past a hot bread shop. You want to go in, even if you're not hungry." I managed to say lightly, "You're telling me Harlan wants me because I smell like a bread roll?" Jilly started to laugh. "What are you witches cackling about?" Sylvia Yarrow asked, passing by. "Witch is not the word for her," Jilly said, when she'd gone out of hearing. "She's angry because she's hurting," I said, without thinking. Jilly gave me a curious look. "How do you know?" I shrugged, spiked a chip bag, and then told the truth again. "I just feel it." "Yeah, well, what I feel is that she's a prime bitch." We picked up rubbish in silence for a while, following the line of the outer fence, and I thought over what Jilly had said about Harlan. Could it be that my extended senses were attracting him? Mrs. Barker had commented about the change in me, and so had Miranda, and even the creepy dream I experienced the night before seemed to suggest Harlan was aware of the change. "So, you liked Sari and the others?" Jilly asked shyly. I was glad to have my thoughts interrupted. "They're great. Harrison was so funny." "He's really smart," Jilly said. "I know. He said on the bus that he's in his last year at school and he's younger than me. How did you meet him?" She shrugged. "I was doing some volunteer work, helping deliver meals to old people. That's when I met Sari, too." "And Raoul?" I asked. "I was doing a class to improve my computer skills, and he was the tutor. We just hit it off so well that we kept in touch." "Then you introduced him to the others?" She nodded. "We're all movie buffs, and Harrison wants to be a director, I know." A vague plan solidified suddenly. "Jilly, would you like to come to my place for dinner one night this week? My dad or brother could pick you up and then bring you home after." "It'd have to be your dad, and he'd have to come in and meet my grandmother, and she'd want him to call first," Jilly said dubiously. I knew that she lived with her elderly grandmother whenever her mother was away on business trips, which was most of the time. I didn't know anything about her father, other than that he'd left his wife and baby daughter and now lived in Paris. Jilly never mentioned him, and rarely spoke of her mother. Most often she talked about her grandmother, but the old seaweed smell that infused her signature odor whenever she talked about the old woman told me the relationship was troubled. Nevertheless, I was confident about Da's ability to charm anybody, and said so. "It helps that he's totally gorgeous," Jilly said. I had introduced her to Da at the end of the school play. Why do you call him Da, anyway? We reached the big blue skip behind the canteen and upended our bins into it. I guess it comes from him calling his own Da that. I wrinkled my nose at the smell and reflected that there was a difference between real bad smells, such as the odorous reek of the garbage and the rotting smell Harlan gave off, but I lacked the words to describe the difference. "What night shall I say to my grandmother?" Jilly asked. "You decide," I said, as we stacked our empty bins and washed our hands. "How about Friday? I could say later." I laughed. "Done." After lunch, I usually had art all afternoon, but the teacher was sick, so I spent the first free period in the computer room typing up a draft of the samurai assignment and printing it out. Jilly was rehearsing with the school band, so I was solo. It wasn't until the bell rang for the next class that I realized one of the band members belonged to Serenity's homeroom group. On impulse, I asked him if he had seen her that day. It was just a way of starting a conversation so I could question him about her, but he stared at me blankly. "Serenity? You know her," one of the girls insisted. "She calls herself Sybil." "Oh, her," the boy curled his lip. "Do you know who she hangs around with?" I asked. They all laughed. "Nobody here," the boy said, and they went out. I finished packing my own papers, wondering if he meant that Serenity hung around with someone outside school. I thought how she turned up outside the library the night before, claiming to have been inside. Was it possible that she hadn't been inside, but had been meeting someone somewhere? But why be so secretive about it? Coming out of the computer room, I forgot Serenity immediately, because Harlan was standing in the passage, filling it with his dreadful rotting stench.
"Hiding from me, were you?"
I thought of him in my dream, saying, "I know what's inside you." Forcing myself to meet his eyes, I said disparagingly, "I suppose I have been hiding out for a bit. It's all this catching up I have to do because of being in hospital. I'm really sick of it."
"Poor baby,"
Harlan crooned, his voice softening. He came a step nearer, and I fought to hide the shudder of horror that passed through me at the thought of him touching me.
"You know I came to school on Saturday to meet you after those tests," he said softly.
"Oh, I didn't see you," I said, praying someone would interrupt us.
"I saw you go off in the car with Barking," he said.
"She offered to drive me home. Don't you like her?" I asked innocently, because it was suddenly clear that he didn't.
"What's to like? She's a teacher," Harlan said lightly, but there was a definite edge to his voice.
"She's a good teacher," I managed to say.
"There's more to life than school, Alison White Star," Harlan said.
I fiercely resisted flinching when he reached out to run his fingers down a strand of hair that had escaped from my ponytail.
"You are a little goody-goody, aren't you?"
He laughed softly. I clamped hard enough on my senses to grey the posters on the wall behind him, and suddenly the air was full of hissing whispers. I was terrified that Harlan would touch my cheek, but he just gave the strand of hair a sharp tug and then went away, saying he'd catch me later. That night, I told Da about asking Jilly to dinner, and he agreed to pick her up, though he joked about getting arrested for driving his beaten-up old van in the most exclusive part of town. His eyes had flashed when I told him he also had to call Jilly's grandmother.
"There hasn't been an elderly lady yet who could resist my undeniable charms," he had boasted.
"You seem cheerful," I laughed.
"Gig tomorrow lunchtime," he said. "A very well-paid job, playing at an upmarket charity function, courtesy of Aaron Race."
"Aaron Race?" I echoed. "What's he got to do with it?"
Da shrugged. "He's connected to the charity. But Alison, I've been thinking about Jesse and how you suggested he write down his thoughts. Your mother said he came into the studio last night at about 4 in the morning and talked to her for 2 hours about his ideas. She didn't understand a word he said, but he was in his room typing again today."
He looked at me thoughtfully. "You might just have created a monster." I felt a thrill of excitement. "Isn't it great?"
Da grinned. "Now if you could just take our poor mixed-up Serenity in hand."
At school the next day, it was the inter-school sports excursion, and I caught the bus knowing that there would be no need to hide from Harlan because he would be competing. Unfortunately, the excursion bus was late, so all the kids going to the sports were streaming out of the entrance when I arrived. Jilly called out, but just as I got to her, Harlan stepped between us, his foul stench swamping her gentle sea fragrance. "Beat it, babe," he told her casually, and she melted away at once. "Why did you do that?" I asked, annoyance at his dismissal overriding caution. He hadn't even looked at Jilly.
"I wanted to talk to you before the bus goes."
Harlan leaned close. "Let's get together tonight after school." "I can't," I said quickly. "I'm supposed to watch my baby brother again."
"Can't someone else take care of the brat, that fat brother of yours?"
His calling Luke a brat and Jesse fat would have angered me if I hadn't been shocked when he knew so much about my family. I babbled something about Da being unhappy about us, trying to avoid family responsibilities, then fell awkwardly silent.
"You're too good, aren't you?"
Harlan said, and this time I heard a sharp spike of impatience in his voice. Then the bus started up and he had to go on board. Classes were both smaller and quieter because almost all of the louder kids had gone to the tournament. Some of the teachers had gone too, so classes were double ups. At lunchtime, I decided to sit under one of the peppercorn trees growing around the oval. Maybe it was because Harlan was weighing so much on my mind that I noticed a kid I had seen hanging around him when he first came to the school. He was sitting on a bench watching a game of football being played by some little kids. "Hi," I said, going over to him, racking my brain for his name. He nodded at me and went back to watching the game. I hesitated a moment, then sat down and unpacked my lunch. "How come you didn't go to the tournament?" He shot me a look that asked why I was asking, but because I was older, he just said, "I'm not into sports." "You used to hang around with Harlan Sanderson, didn't you? And he's pretty sporty." His name came to me then, Cole. I had shifted the screen to a thinner segment, and at the mention of Harlan, his wet dog's smell thickened and became less pleasant. My heart beat faster, because the smell told me that, like Mrs. Barker, Cole did not like Harlan.
"That was last year," Cole said.
"You don't hang out with him anymore?" I let my eyes follow the ball as it sailed away from the toe of a little kid, as if I was hardly interested in his answer. But Cole sat very still, like a mouse, hoping a cat would not see him. I felt a surge of impatience. I wanted to know what lay behind Harlan's smell, and the fact that Cole had liked Harlan and now clearly no longer did made me certain he knew something to Harlan's discredit. Maybe it was the same thing Mrs. Barker knew, but it had to have happened before he came to our school. So how did Cole come to know about it? On impulse, I asked, "Do you know what school Harlan went to before he came here?" At the same time, I pushed the question at him mentally as well, hoping a focused sent message would encourage him to talk. "He went to a private school called Shale something," Cole answered promptly, in a jerky monotone. I was startled into looking directly at him and saw with a shock that his face had gone chalk white. His eyes, turned to me, were dark and cowed. He looked, I realized with a sick jolt, the way Leona's victims looked. But I hadn't bullied him, I told myself. It was true that I had mentally urged him to tell me what I needed, but that didn't qualify as bullying, did it? My bewildered silence had given Cole time to collect himself. "Why are you asking me all these questions?" he demanded. "Did Harlan send you to test me? I told him I wouldn't say anything, and I haven't." I opened my mouth and shut it again, hardly able to believe what he had just said. At the same time, my danger sense began to thrum, and I realized, too late, that Cole was bound to tell Harlan I had been questioning him. Without even thinking about it, I stared at Cole and said, "You don't need to mention this to Harlan, Cole. Just forget about it." I thought the same thing as hard as I could, feeling sick at the way he paled even further. Then he looked confused. "Sorry, did you want something?" Reeling from what I had done, I managed to stammer that I had only asked what time it was. He checked his watch, told me, then got up and walked away. I sat there for another 20 minutes, trying to understand how I could have willed Cole to talk about Harlan when he hadn't wanted to, had promised not to, and then willed him to forget. I had wished people to do things dozens of times since the accident, and no one had given any sign of obeying me before now. The only thing I could think of was that there was something about Cole that had allowed me to dominate him. I calmed down a bit then, because this fitted my theory that my enhanced abilities had primitive origins. Animals were always dominating one another, sometimes by force, but more often by will. One animal seemed to know if another had a stronger will, and would just signal acceptance. It must be that Cole had acceded to me in the same way weaker animals did when challenged by a dominant animal. I turned my mind to what Cole had said, and a chill ran down my spine as the significance hit me anew. He had promised Harlan to say nothing about something, and I was suddenly sure that it was not only the same thing Mrs. Barker knew, but also the thing that made him smell so dreadful. I would not get any more out of Cole unless I was prepared to force him to speak, and I wasn't, because even if I had not set out to bully him, that was what I had done. But maybe I didn't need to question Cole now that he had told me that Harlan had gone to a private school with Shale in the name. The school had to be in or near Shale Town, which was only a couple of hours' train ride up the coast. I could go there and question some of the kids Harlan's age to see what they knew about him. I didn't know the school, but I knew Shale Town pretty well, especially the bit around the Shale Town Detention Center, where refugees were sent while they waited to find out if they were allowed to stay in our country. Just over a year ago, there had been a lot of political upheaval that had brought a stream of refugees to the detention center, and a big political furore had erupted because the government had insisted on sending all but a few of the refugees back to their war-torn country. There had been endless articles in the paper with politicians talking about limited resources and quotas and terrorists, and other politicians talking about children and women and terror and compassion. Dar had gone to the detention center with some other musicians to help protest, and had ended up speaking with a refugee, a girl a year younger than I had been. Aya and Dar had begun to correspond, and from those letters and later visits, he had learned that she had two tiny brothers, a mother and a father also in the detention center. They had left their country because her father had disagreed too openly with those in power. Dar ended up writing to the newspapers and to politicians, like a lot of other people did, asking why innocent people should be kept in a prison for an unknown time, after which they would probably be sent back to their own countries. In her letters, Aya had talked of her fears for herself and her father and her brothers if they were refused permission to stay. The letters had been heartbreaking, were heartbreaking, for Dar had them still. Aya had talked a lot about her small brothers, and you could tell how much she loved them. Once, she wrote in a rare, bitter mood that she had not realized that being a refugee meant you would be treated like a criminal, even if you were a tiny baby. She said that she could not believe our government would be so cruel as to send their family away. Dar had taken Serenity and me with him sometimes to the center when he visited, and we had both got to know the gentle, doe-eyed Aya. It had been a terrible shock when we found out the government had refused Aya's family permission to remain. Dar had done everything he could, but in the end, they had been sent back, and Aya had never written again. We had no idea what had happened to her and her family. There had been such awful stories at the time of the fate of refugees sent back. In the days when we had been trying to get the government to change its mind, I had felt as if something was winding tight in me, as one after another avenue proved useless. I had felt helpless and frightened, but Serenity had been utterly certain that something would happen to rescue them, even at the last minute. It occurred to me now, the whole Aya thing had been the last time I had really felt close to Serenity. I could remember vividly how shattered she had been when she finally realized what all the rest of us had figured out some time earlier, that there was no way to stop Aya and her family from being sent back. She had been so angry at Dar. "You talk about doing the right thing, so do something," she had screamed at him. Of course, there had been nothing he could do that he had not already tried. Aside from writing letters, he'd offered to sponsor the whole family and support them until they were on their feet. He had said this in an open letter in the newspaper, but hundreds of people had written, making similar offers regarding other refugees, all to no avail. The government only reiterated their determination to take a tough stance, calling the desperate letters of refugees emotional blackmail. Dar had not reproached Serenity for her unfairness. I had been angry at her for so unjustly attacking him, but I had been even more confused that the government has simply dismissed our passionate opposition to their decision. How could they not listen when they were supposed to represent us? Dar told me sadly that there were a lot of people who voted for the government because they wanted the refugees sent back to their own countries. They don't want to imagine how it is for a refugee, because thinking about people who are poor or frightened makes them feel unhappy and guilty at how comfortable and safe their own lives are. I knew that Dar still wrote letters to the government and to various organizations in our country and Ayers, trying to locate the family and urging that the laws about refugees and political asylum be changed. But nothing had changed, except that the newspapers had found something else to write about. I was no better than the government, I thought, feeling suddenly ashamed. I had not thought of Aya for a long time, and wasn't it this sort of easy forgetting that allowed politicians to get away with their terrible inhuman decisions? It came to me all at once that perhaps Serenity had not forgotten, that this, even though she had never spoken of Aya again after she and her family had left the country, might lie at the core of her transformation. She had been so terribly angry and upset that final day, when we had gone with a lot of other people to make a last protest and stand vigil to force the media to at least report the result of the government's policy, all of us except Mum, who had been very close to having Luke. Thinking back and focusing on Serenity, as I had not done at the time, it seemed to me that she had not truly understood that we had failed until Dar and the band began Song for Aya. I had seen the baffled rage on her face as she watched him sing. Dear, gentle, sorrowing Da, who was singing the song he had written, because there was nothing else he could do. The song was not a protest song, despite what Aaron Race had said. It was a gentle and terribly sad ballad, and so beautiful that it had silenced the shouts and rage and jeers of the crowd. A helicopter that had brought last-minute news crews carried away footage that was replayed many times on television in the weeks after the protest. The television cameras had also filmed the police stopping Dar towards the end of the song to tell him he had no right to perform there without a busker's license. Dar talked with them for the longest time, and even in the few seconds that made it to air, you could see those policemen found it hard to know how to deal with a man who was so nice and persistent and gentle. They had been trained to deal with people who were angry and wanting to hurt or smash something. A record company had called Da, wanting to release the song, but Da had refused, saying it was Aya's song and that only she could decide what to do with it. Miranda had thought Da was being idiotic, and Neil had said they ought to do it if only to raise awareness about the plight of the refugees. They could donate all the money they made, but Da wouldn't budge. "I wrote that song for Aya," he said, "and until she's safe and free and able to hear it, nothing can be done with it other than singing it." Unlike the others, I had felt like I understood. It would have been wrong to make a record, no matter who profited, when Aya had vanished and might even be dead, she and her whole family. The night after that final protest, I had found it really hard to sleep. The sound of Dar playing the guitar drew me downstairs, but when I looked from the doorway, he seemed so weary and hurt that I had not wanted to interrupt him. I had gone back to bed to lie in the dark, thinking about Aya and her little brothers, and wondering where they were and what was happening to them, wondering how it would feel if that were my family. I had called out to Serenity, but she had been asleep. Yet now, sitting on the bench by the oval in sunlight that would not warm me, I wondered if she had really been sleeping at all. There had been a week of despair and guilt and anger after the protest, when the rest of us couldn't seem to talk about anything else, and there had been phone calls from journalists trying to rehash the story or link it to others. Da had been invited to speak to a few organizations, and there had been talk of a concert to raise money for refugees. But then Mum had gone into labor, and there had been the swift and thrilling trip to the beach in the old van with the midwife, and the long wait until Luke made his entrance into the world, and life had gone on except maybe it hadn't gone on for Serenity. I decided to catch the regular bus home that night because it was half empty. To my surprised pleasure, Harrison was on it. I went to sit next to him, wondering, when it was too late, if that would embarrass him. He might have read my mind, for he grinned at me and said in a loud whisper, "You have to stop meeting like this." The businessman in the seat across the aisle gave us a suspicious look that reduced us both to spurts of laughter. Then he looked indignant, and that made it worse. What is it about laughter that the more you try to repress it, the more hysterical you get? "How come you're out so far?" I asked when we got ourselves under control. Harrison gave me a burning look. "Because I wanted to see you again, my bonny lassie." I laughed in delight at his exaggerated Scottish accent. "But seriously, you want to come over to my place for a while? You could just get a later bus to see your friend. Is that where you're going?" He looked as surprised to receive the invitation as I felt to find myself offering it, and I half expected him to refuse, but he just nodded and said why not. On the way from the stop to our house, I asked him which school Sari went to, and he said she didn't mostly. "A lot of people think she's a bit crazy, and she is, but only in a nice way."
"Nicely crazy?"
He grinned and shrugged, saying comfortably, "I think a bit of craziness is good for the world." Fair was in the kitchen with Mel and Titch, talking about a gig they'd done that day and arguing over the arrangement of one of the songs they had played. I introduced them and asked Dar how the gig had gone. He grinned and said it had been great. They had been paid on the spot. Harrison didn't blink at Mel's hair or the fact that Titch looked a lot like a white Stevie Wonder, right down to the rocking from side to side like a distressed elephant.
"Good to meet you, Harrison," Dar said and shook his hand.
"Harrison, after the Star Wars guy?" Mel asked.
"Unfortunately, yes," Harrison answered. "I think my parents wanted to make sure I'd have an inferiority complex so they could control me better."
Dar grinned, but Mel launched into his "if I were running the world" speech, shifting the focus to attack, oppression, and injustice within the traditional bourgeois family unit.
"Mel, give us a break," Dar groaned.
"Harrison, this man is not related by blood to us, so don't worry."
"Oh, he likes crazy people," I said, and hustled Harrison out and up the stairs.
"Very funny," Harrison said. "Now your father thinks I'm a nutter."
"It's okay, he likes crazy people too," I said.
Miranda was coming out of the bathroom, her hair wet and dripping and very green.
"Green is a very organic colour, don't you think?" she asked in that vague way she has when she's in the process of changing colours. "I think it's like the trance snakes go into before they shed their skins."
"Is she on drugs?"
Harrison asked when she drifted downstairs.
"She's on colours," I said, opening the door.
Harrison stopped in the doorway at the sight of Serenity's side of the room.
"What's here? You're schizophrenic? Or does that just represent your dark side?"
"I wish. That's my sister's half of the room. Her name used to be Serenity, but she's turning herself into Sybil."
Instead of asking if Serenity was a vampire, like Miranda's friends always did when they saw her side of the room, Harrison asked, quite seriously, if there was something wrong with her. This was so unexpected that I found myself telling him about her transformation into Sybil, her growing isolation within the family, her thinness, and her strange aggression. I didn't mention the thoughts I'd had that day about her transformation having been triggered by the fate of Aya and her family, but I ended up telling him about how she had suddenly appeared outside the library, claiming to have been inside all along, though I had looked for her without success. She accused me of following her. Harrison turned his grey eyes to me.
"Maybe you should. You said she goes to the library every Monday. Go after her next time. See where she goes."
"Wouldn't it be kind of sneaky?" I asked doubtfully.
He shrugged, a light lift of his shoulders.
"She's your sister, and you're worried about her. What else would a decent person do but be sneaky?"
I laughed, as he meant me to. Then I sobered. "I am really worried about her."
"You share a room with her. Maybe subconsciously you ken that she's in some kind of trouble. After all, the things you consciously notice are only part of what your mind takes in. A lot of other information comes to you subconsciously. I believe our senses extend right from our conscious to our subconscious."
I actually felt dizzy.
"Extended senses?" "Aye. A lot of abilities that we call paranormal are probably just extensions of normal senses that work beneath the level of consciousness.
Harrison walked over to Serenity's table and reached out to touch a finger to the slightly withered lily. He said softly, "People can be crumbling inside without anyone knowing about it. You shouldn't think you have all the time in the world to do something, Alison. Bad stuff can come so fast it'll make your head spin. You'd never forgive yourself if something happened and you hadn't tried to act."
His words made me feel cold.
"I'll do it if you like," he offered diffidently. "Less chance of a spotting me."
As I walked Harrison back to his bus stop an hour later, I told him that Jilly was coming to dinner on Friday, if her gran agreed. "Do you want to come as well?"
"Another time," he said. "It's better if your sister doesn't know what I look like if I'm going to follow her. The main thing is that I ken what she looks like."
He patted the pocket containing the photo he had chosen from those I had offered. It was actually a newspaper clipping of Serenity and me, taken during the Shale Town protest, and had led me to tell him about Aya after all. But I hadn't connected it to Serenity's transformation, because it seemed so disconnected from her furtiveness at the library. Back home, I felt amazed at how much I had told him, let alone that I had agreed he should follow my sister and spy on her for me. It was what he had said about extended senses that had made me trust him so much. I mean, what was the chance of a person whose senses had been accidentally extended meeting someone who would mention extended senses? It made me think of this book called Cat's Cradle, where one of the characters in it believes that some people belonging to a group containing people and animals and even objects that are linked and destined to tangle and intersect and affect one another over and over because of some central thing connecting them all, which they don't know about. Harrison and I could be members of that kind of group. It would explain why I felt so easy with him as soon as we met, and maybe even how we had happened to bump into one another on the bus. The only thing I couldn't figure out was what the central focus of our group could be.
18. When I got back home, Mel's van had gone, and there was a gleaming white limousine in the driveway. Inside, Aaron Race was seated at the kitchen table, on the same chair as before, wearing a dark grey tux and a snowy white shirt. Beside him was a stunningly beautiful woman with a black evening dress so plain and perfect that even I knew it had to be a designer gown worth thousands. Her hair was black too, and coiled into a perfect lacquered chignon, secured with enormous diamond-studded spikes.
"Alison, you remember Mr. Race?" Gar said. "This is his wife, Dita."
I nodded to the entrepreneur, and once again I felt the little fish of his attention nudging and butting at my screen. Afraid the dislike I felt would show on my face, I turned to his wife and was startled by how familiar her face seemed. Then I realized it was just the kind of perfectly made-up beauty she had, which you saw every other minute on magazine covers.
"Pleased to meet you, Alison," Dita Race said in a smoky, caressing voice.
I muttered something and slipped out. Miranda was sitting on the stairs eating an apple and playing with Luke. "What goes on?" I asked, nodding back towards the kitchen.
"Who knows?" she said. "They turned up about an hour ago, and that guy and Dad have been talking up a storm ever since."
"About what?"
She shrugged. "Life, love, the pursuit of happiness. All of them? Even the wife?"
"Dita, Dita, on the wall," Miranda trilled softly, fluttering her eyelashes, and we both laughed. "I wonder what they want." I knew Aaron Race had arranged a gig for Dad during the day, but that didn't explain why he was here, and with his wife. As if reading my mind, Miranda said darkly, "Guys like Aaron Race don't just drop by to shoot the breeze. Everything they do is for a reason. But if he just wants to manage losing the rope, why doesn't he just say so? What's with all the pussyfooting around?" I shrugged, thinking of how my extended senses had shown me Aaron Race's concealed excitement the last time he had been here. I didn't know what he wanted, but like Miranda, I was sure he wanted something. Aaron Race began to laugh, and we both stopped, listening to it. "That is a seriously great laugh," Miranda mused. "Pity the guy who owns it is such a void."
"A void?" I asked.
"That's what Ricky calls someone who, when they walk into the room, it feels like someone walked out.
Speaking of Ricky, I'd better get my act together. I've got a hot date with him tonight.
Luke stretched his arms out to me, and I took him, thinking Miranda had found the perfect way to describe Aaron Race. A void. A dark absence. Maybe that was why I couldn't smell him.
Mum called out to bring Luke in for his bath, and I carried him into the bathroom, where she was stretched out like a mermaid, with her hair flowing in wet lines over her white breasts and shoulders. I was struck again by how amazingly beautiful she was.
"Did you meet that Aaron Race guy?" I asked, undressing Luke and handing him into the bath.
Mum lowered him into the water, and he chirruped with delight and splashed wildly. She laughed and began to kiss him all over. She hadn't heard me. I wasn't annoyed. There was no point in being annoyed with Mum for being who she was.
I watched Luke wriggle and plough the water for a bit, thinking how it must remind him of being inside Mum. I knew it was really cramped in there by the time a baby was ready to be born. But somehow I could only ever imagine Luke lying at the rippled edge of a vast sea under an endless reddish dusk, waiting to be born into the world. Partly it was how Mum's stomach had sounded when she was pregnant that made me think that way. Listening to it had been like listening to the sea inside a shell. But also, it was because that was how it had been when Luke was born beside a sea on fire with a bloody luminous light from the setting sun. I left Mum and Luke to their bath and went back down to the kitchen to make myself a sandwich. Da and Aaron Race were still intent on their discussion.
"It's true," Da was saying. "Great art comes out of suffering, but you can't suffer to order."
"Exactly," Aaron Race said eagerly. Dieter Race had curled her legs up under her on the chair, and she was now watching Da like a cat watches birds when it's too fat and full to chase them. I moved close enough to smell her and almost gagged at the weird, sickly combination of wet cement dust, overripe banana, and musky incense.
"I'm not saying it's obligatory to suffer," Da was saying earnestly, "but you do have to go down into yourself to see what you're made of, and I don't see how you can do that if you're worrying about changing the world. It's looking outward when you should be looking inward."
"But don't you think that striving towards the world is also a kind of suffering? A generous suffering, because it's less eye-focused?" Race asked.
Da thought about that.
"You have a point. Maybe it's possible to be a true artist with integrity and a desire to save the world from itself. But I'm not that kind of artist. For me, it's very introverted and very personal."
"I can see that," Race said.
He turned to Dieter.
"You can see that in his music, can't you, my dear? I mean," he added, without waiting for her to respond, "you could see it better if you were a soloist, of course, or if you had a band which was more in the background."
"How do you mean?" Da asked.
Race shrugged.
"The day your striving was a little obscured by all that was going on in the music and on the stage. Each of the musicians in Losing the Rope is so different. I can see what you say about this personal questing with music, but I find it hard to equate that with being in a band, and with this band in particular."
Da frowned. "I think Losing the Rope has an energy that comes from our being individuals, as well as our unity, and from having respect for one another."
Race made a self-deprecating gesture.
"I'm only a man who takes an interest. But when I see you on stage, McCall, I see a band built like scaffolding around a soloist with vision that gets a little muddied. In any case, I enjoy the performance today, and the organizers were very pleased."
He laughed that gorgeous, welling chuckle. Dieter gave him a radiant, strangely avid smile, and Race lifted a beautifully tailored cuff and looked at his watch.
"We had better get moving, my dear. We have a reception to go to. Thanks for the coffee and the chat, McCall. Once again, it has been edifying."
Da got up.
"Well, thanks again for suggesting us for the charity function, and of course for the Urban Dingo gig. I had no idea before you told me that it was your doing."
He shook hands, and I was aware again of the way they both affected the air around them. I tried to figure out the difference in the effects, but the distortion was too hard to see clearly. Then I remembered how clamping hard enough to inhibit my normal senses had enabled me to hear the disembodied whispering more clearly. I tried it, and the sound of Da's voice saying goodbye faded along with the colour in the room. At the same time, the whispering grew louder, but my attention was riveted on the distortions in the air around both Da and Aaron Race, which now showed quite clearly. There was a difference in how each man affected the air. Around Da, the air bent outward, as if he was emanating something, but around Aaron Race, it bent just as strongly inward, as if he was sucking something towards him. It was as if they were exact opposites. It was fascinating and completely mysterious. I let my senses go back to normal and watched Dita insinuate herself off the chair like she'd taken a course in it. Dao went out to their car to see them off, and I gathered my wits and pulled the phone book towards me. It took me less than a minute to learn that there was a Shaletown Primary and a Shaletown Secondary College in Shaletown, but no private school with Shale in the name. In fact, no private school in Shaletown at all, so far as I could tell. I was pretty disappointed, but I wrote down the number for Shale Secondary College, just in case. Da came back in.
That's an interesting man, but he has some pretty strange ideas about what it means to be a creator of anything.
Probably because he's not, I said. Da looked surprised.
That's true. I suppose his ideas are quite legitimate from the point of view of a manager.
Except he's not. He just
takes an interest, Da said.
He was smiling, but he still had a furrow between his brows, as if something the other man said had got under his skin. He washed some dishes absently.
I guess we're lucky that he takes an interest, since it turns out the gig with Urban Dingo was his doing. He said he'd heard Song for Aya, and it had impressed him enough to recommend me. He doesn't realize the band is as much a part of the creation of that song as I am. But I'm a bit puzzled about where he would have heard it after all this time, since it's never been recorded.
Someone made a pirate recording. Da, what do you know about her, Dita? I said. He slanted me a look of amusement.
I should think all there is to know about Dita Race is pretty obvious.
I nodded. But what does she do? Is she a model? Because she sort of looked familiar to me.
He shrugged. She shops. Her words, he added dryly.
Da threw the tea towel aside and went out, saying he'd better get organized, because he had a new student arriving any minute. I finished drying the dishes and was wiping down the benches when the student arrived. I showed him the path to the shed studio and went back to the kitchen, just as Mum came in with her hair all wrapped up in a towel. She was dressed in her painting clothes, but Luke was dressed for bed in his flannel bunny suit. Mum gave me a vague, fond smile and set about making a fresh pot of green tea to take up to her studio. Luke tucked into her hip, gurgling sleepily. I wished I could have talked to her about Serenity, but Mum never had been the one we talked to about our problems. She was always too preoccupied by whatever it was that kept her painting. Mesmerized by her muse, Miranda said. Mostly I didn't mind. I was even kind of proud to have such an unusual and talented mother. But just occasionally, I wished she was more normal. Mum drifted out carrying tray and baby with effortless grace, her expression one of dreamy absorption. I had the feeling that if Race and his Dita were there, she wouldn't even have noticed them. The next afternoon I had four periods of science with Jilly. We were supposed to work in pairs, and soon Jilly and I were industriously sorting bones and trying to see how they connected. "Are these real?" Jilly wondered.
"I hope not," I said. "I don't mind if they are," Jilly went on. "I just like knowing what's real and what's not real."
I couldn't help making some stupid reference to the horror movies, which led her to do the same, and we were quietly laughing when Mr. Straven's voice snapped across the room like a whip crack.
"Miss Roundtree, I assume you've made some astounding discovery," he said icily. "Perhaps you'd inform the rest of the class of your amazing breakthrough."
"I'm sorry, Mr. Straven," Jilly muttered. "Crusty old grump," I said, when we were dismissed for lunch. "He's not really," Jilly said. "It's just that he cares about science, and it must be frustrating for him to be here teaching kids who don't pay attention."
"But you do pay attention," I protested.
"Well, that's why he's mad, don't you see? He trusts me to take science seriously, and he feels I let him down." I looked at her in wonder. "Jilly, you ought to have a halo. Do you mind if we sit in the library study room for lunch?"
"What else?" she asked.
"I know you're not an outdoor person." I told her that I was only an indoor person when there were wild animals outside. I had meant it as a lame kind of joke, but
but she looked serious. So who's the beast we're hiding from?
Harlan?
I stared at her, and she said, It's funny. On the excursion bus yesterday, after he talked to you, I saw him looking out the window and watching you go into the school. He looked, I don't know, like a cat watching a mouse, not the way a guy in love ought to look. You should tell him you're not interested. I don't want to make him mad.
You're scared of him, Jilly said, in disbelief.
I shrugged, wishing I'd said nothing. Jilly went on slowly. I suppose you feel there's something wrong about Harlan, just the same way you sensed Sylvia Yarrow was angry at herself. I said, a bit defiantly, Don't you ever get feelings around people? Jilly was quiet for a bit. Then she said, I found out something about Sylvia that might explain why she's so angry.
What?
I asked, curiously. Her father had an affair, and Sylvia discovered them together. She told her mother and there was this big fight, and her parents split up. Then her mother had a nervous breakdown, so Sylvia has to live with her father and his new girlfriend.
How horrible, I said. No wonder she smells of anger.
Smells of anger? I mean, she seems so angry. Jilly gave me a funny look, and I cursed my carelessness. I liked Jilly and trusted her, but I didn't want her to change the way she acted towards me. Wasn't that the whole reason I had decided to keep my extended senses secret? To distract her, I told her about bumping into Harrison, and before I knew it, I had also told her about Serenity and my feeling that there was something wrong with her. Too late, I realized that I had brought us full circle back to my mysterious ability to feel things about people. But fortunately, Jilly was concentrating on the subject. Like Harrison, she took my concern more seriously than I expected. I told her, half shyly, that he had offered to follow Serenity to see what she did on Monday nights. It seems kind of extreme, but if Harrison thinks it's a good idea, she said doubtfully, I hardly know him. But I trust him, I said. It's because he has integrity, Jilly answered. It's the same with Sari and Raoul. Whenever I'm presented with any kind of moral dilemma, I try to think what they'd do. Sari with her offbeat way of seeing life, Raoul with his honesty, and Harrison with his intelligence. Integrity, I thought. What a beautiful word it was. But people didn't use it much anymore. Yet it fitted all of them, Jilly as much as the other three. They're lucky to have you too, I said stoutly. Jilly hugged me.
Am I interrupting something?
Harlan was standing in the doorway, smiling, and I suddenly realized how much I disliked his perfect, ever-present smile.
I was just congratulating Alizon on doing so well in her tests, Jilly said, too brightly.
Well, she's a smart girl, Harlan said. Why shouldn't she do well?
Exactly what I was saying, Jilly said.
So why don't you make like the west wind and blow?
Oh, I'd love to, Harlan, but we're supposed to help Mrs. Straven with setting up an experiment, Jilly said. We should be there now, because he wants it ready for when his next class begins.
Harlan's smile did not falter.
All right, I'll be waiting at the front gate for you after school, Alizon.
We watched him walk across the library, through the wall of glass windows that surrounded the study room.
Hell on wheels, Jilly said, when he had gone out of sight. She looked at me, and her face changed.
You're shaking, Alizon.
I couldn't help it. I started to cry.
Jilly made a soundless exclamation and gathered me into her arms.
Don't worry, she said. I'll figure something out.
19. Harlan's charming smile did not slip when he saw Jilly glued to my side as we came out of the school gates.
What are you two, Siamese twins? He asked lightly.
I know it's a pain, Jilly said in a friendly, dithery voice. I'm really sorry to be a gooseberry like this, Harlan, but Alizon's coming home to my place for dinner tonight. You left so fast at lunchtime that we didn't have a chance to say. I'll just read my book over here while you two talk. Don't mind me.
She sat on the front fence and opened a book and pretended to read. Harlan stepped closer, still smiling, and took hold of my arm. His fingers dug through the cloth into my flesh, seeming sharper than fingers ought to feel, like claws, some crazy bit of me thought.
So,
When are we going out? He asked.
It depends on what? Your baby brother? Your father? Her?
He nodded towards Jilly. Do you have a mind of your own, Alison?
Oh, I, of course I do, I said indignantly. I just don't get why you're so angry.
For a moment, Harlan's smile vanished, and I realized with a shock that I had never seen him without it. He looked younger and oddly vacant. Then he was smiling again.
Well, I guess I feel frustrated. You say you'd like to go out, yet somehow it never happens. How about us setting a date for a real date?
Be careful, my danger sense whispered, and I remembered Mrs. Barker telling me it would be better not to humiliate Harlan. There was nothing to do but nod.
So when? Harlan asked, with just a flick of mockery.
I could meet you on Saturday afternoon, I said, reasoning that I could arrange something afterwards to keep the meeting short.
Where?
Harlan asked swiftly. The coffee shop in Eastland Mall. The Quick Brown Fox, 1 o'clock? Harlan nodded easily and let go of my arm. As he walked away, he glanced over at Jilly, and maybe it was my imagination, but I thought I saw triumph in his eyes. See? Jilly said, when he was out of earshot. She looked so pleased, I didn't have the heart to tell her I had been forced to agree to a date. Jilly hooked her arm through mine. Come on, my grandmother will be wondering where we are. What? She grinned. I figured it better have the ring of truth. When I told Harlan you were coming home with me, so I called my grandmother. You can okay it with your parents from there. You said they were pretty easy to get along with. So I went to Jilly's place for dinner. We were driven there in an expensive, sober black car by a chauffeur called Samuel. It's very short notice, her grandmother said. After we arrived, Jilly had brought me to where the old woman had been sitting and reading in a large, beautifully furnished drawing room right inside the front door. Her smile had more politeness than warmth.
We are only having a tuna casserole and salad, and Jilly mentioned that you are a vegetarian.
Salad will be fine, I said, encouraged by the fact that, despite her unfriendly manner, the old woman smelled of ripe blackberries and rosemary. Jilly was no less stiff than her grandmother, and it took some time and some subtle smelling and watching to figure out that she believed her grandmother kept her out of duty. For her part, Mrs. Roundtree thought Jilly resented being abandoned to the care of an old woman. It surprised me that two such smart people could have got one another so terribly wrong. When we went upstairs to do our homework before dinner, I saw that the house was enormous and perfectly ordered, room after room filled with beautifully polished antique furniture. What stopped it looking like a house in a magazine were the worn but gorgeous rugs on the timber floors and all sorts of unusual things set about in every room. A strange little saddle chair, statues that looked African, beautiful old tapestries, ceramic bowls and enormous but dented pewter jugs. There were also paintings, most of them abstracts, which surprised me, hanging amidst family portraits. Jilly whispered with a grimace that the subjects of the portraits were round trees, which explained their sour faces. When we came up the stairs, Jilly pointed out a picture of her mother and father on the day they had married. They were definitely beautiful people, but they looked stiff and miserable despite their wide white smiles. I thought of my own family, rich in love and poor in money, and knew where I'd rather be. Still, wealth definitely had its compensations. Jilly's room had an ensuite bathroom and a walk-in wardrobe that was so full it was like a dress shop. There were also shelves of toys and ornaments from round the world. Jilly said bluntly that it was all compensation from her globe-trotting mother. She showed me a pile of fancy clothes, still in wrappers, and said her mother had bought them on her last trip to Paris. They're a size too small. I guess it's been a while since she looked at me, she added with bitter humour. Your gran seems okay, I said. She does her duty. Are you sure that's all it is? Jilly didn't answer. She was pulling out drawers full of CDs. She was upset, so I let her play me the music she liked, and we spent an hour trying out dance steps. We finally turned on some softer music and did our homework. We had just finished, and Jilly was beginning to expound her theory that Harlan was pursuing me precisely because I didn't want him, when a maid came to tell us that Cook wanted us down for dinner. I couldn't believe Jilly lived in a house where there was a maid and a cook and a chauffeur. I didn't think people had servants anymore, I whispered, as we followed the maid to the dining room. My grandmother calls them her staff.